This weekend starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Will Weinstein be a watershed? I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for joining us on This Weekend. Here's what's coming up this hour. The sexual harassment claims against Hollywood exec Harvey Weinstein and others have created a lot of attention, but will the story be a watershed moment for the issue? On the tech front, when smartphones will become obsolete and what will replace them? Also, is the World Series between the Astros and Dodgers the one that begins to claw back baseball fans that had given up on the game? And the effort to get rid of the metric system in England.
It's a group of mostly men who are retired, and they have for many years now made it their mission to get rid of the metric system in the UK. And I mean, the UK is in this interesting position where it really uses a mix of both metric and imperial, and they think there should be no mention of metric anywhere in the country.
Wall Street Journal reporter Jenny Gross on some unusual UK vigilantes. She's here later in the hour. The Harvey Weinstein scandal is being hailed as a watershed moment, but many moments that first appear to be watersheds are not, and many that really are watersheds become apparent only in retrospect. USA Today national correspondent Rick Hampson looked at some examples. Rick, what have you found?
Many of these moments really aren't watersheds. And the real watershed moments that do occur often pass unnoticed at the time. And I was wondering if the Harvey Weinstein case fell into the former category, something that seems like a big deal now, but won't a couple of years from now.
Mm. All right, so one of the things we've seen come out of this, as you point out, is the hashtag MeToo campaign on social media. Is that an indicator this might be a start of something or no?
I'm somewhat skeptical about the role of social media here. It's great that people are able to share their stories, but when the next big story comes along, social media tends to move on to that. And the question is, what effect is it having, say, on corporate HR departments? It's not clear that it would have any. Furthermore, a lot of these Me Too stories are experiences people have had in the past. The current reality might be quite different. If this happened 10, 20 years ago to you, if you were a woman sexually harassed in the workplace, maybe there's been reform in your company, in your HR department, so that they really have a much tighter lock on this. Mm. So it's good to hear the stories, but it doesn't mean that things are going to be changing in the future as a result of them.
What were a couple of the events that you looked at that maybe some thought might be a watershed moment, but turned out not to be?
I think there's two outstanding examples. One is the Newtown massacre in 2012 at Sandy Hook Elementary. I think a lot of people assumed there was going to be some sort of gun control legislation. Now, regardless of what you think about gun control, it did seem that this sort of a thing was going to give impetus to the political forces that favored it. It didn't happen at all. Not only did nothing get passed through Congress, gun sales actually increased. Another example would be the 2008 presidential election. Now, there's no question the election of our first African-American president was itself a watershed. But in terms of an agenda, a lot of what Obama achieved now is very much under fire by his successor. So on that score, you have to say, was it really the watershed people thought it would be?
We're speaking with USA Today national correspondent Rick Hampson. He's written a piece entitled, "Will Harvey Weinstein Case Be a Watershed Moment?" Experience says probably not. How about events we might have overlooked as watershed moments?
A couple of examples come to mind. In 1998, a University of Wyoming student, Matthew Shepard, was a gay man, was murdered. Since then, we've had a real crackdown on hate crimes. Almost every kind of police jurisdiction. Back in 1980, a woman who had lost her child in an automobile accident founded Mothers Against Drunk Driving, which has had a revolutionary impact on our attitudes about alcohol and vehicles, the notion of a designated driver, the drinking age. These people have had an enormous political effect, and the date they were founded, which was September 5, 1980, it's safe to say that nobody back then was saying, well, this is really a watershed moment.
Yeah.
But it was.
Interesting. What were, explain the reasons you put together about the Weinstein case, why it's so unusual, and is this challenge, as you say, who try to predict its eventual impact?
Unusual events can be watersheds. Pearl Harbor doesn't get attacked every day, and Pearl Harbor, the attack thereon, was clearly a watershed. But in other ways, if something happens, and it's really so exceptional and unusual, it's not going to affect the normal course of events. And I think the Weinstein case might fit into that. For one thing, the accuser is such an ogre, is being presented as such an ogre, that he isn't necessarily your average workplace sexual harasser who needs to get his head turned around. This guy was a serial predator, allegedly, over many years. And similarly, the people who were accusing him are some of the most famous women in America, Gwyneth Paltrow and Angelina Jolie. Hardly the status of your normal working stiff who finds herself or himself, you know, under attack on the workplace. Also, just the setting of Hollywood. This case is getting so much attention because it's Hollywood and it's celebrities. Most workplaces are not like Hollywood. Most workplaces don't have, you know, beautiful people striving to become world famous, being judged by powerful people whose standards are completely subjective.
Thanks, Rick. USA Today national correspondent Rick Hampson. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Fly ball, left field, it's deep, Gonzalez to the wall, gone, a home run! Corey Seager, out with the bad back, is all the way back, and the Dodgers have a 3-1 lead!
Charlie Steiner, Dodgers Radio Network, with the Fall Classic well underway, can baseball deliver another revival moment? This has become the time of year when we're accustomed to pronouncing baseball's decline, right? Pointing to its shrinking TV ratings and the love of football. But football's been wilting under the spotlight lately with its own audience issues. Could baseball seize the opportunity? Here's Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay. Jason, what have you put together?
You know, for the last, I don't know, couple of decades, it seems that we've all been in agreement that baseball is on the wane and football is king, right? That football is just the dominant sport in this country. It dominates the television ratings, and baseball should be so lucky as to sniff what's a top 20 rating for football. But last year we saw a spectacular World Series with the Cubs and the Indians and, of course, you know, a streak on the line there and some incredible numbers. Game 7 of the World Series last year, 40 million people watched, which is a crazy number for baseball. And so heading into this World Series and looking at all the myriad of issues that are facing the NFL right now, political, injury issues, quality of play, you know, is there an opportunity for baseball to bounce back and steal more of that spotlight? Now, I don't doubt for a second that every television executive in the universe would have preferred the Yankees to make the World Series over the Houston Astros. But, you know, Houston's a terrific team, won 101 ball games this year. This is the first time two 100-win teams have met in the World Series since 1970.
Wow.
It's a high-quality matchup, and will be interesting to see. I mean, look, it's not going to somehow eclipse the Super Bowl rating or anything like that or anything close, but there's an opportunity for another sport to go in there and grab a little bit of mind share.
Too late, too slow, too long. That's been my complaint for a long time. Does that matter when you have two really quality teams like this?
I think it absolutely matters, and I think it would be wise with baseball to, you know, tinker with the product more. I think baseball is a sport that thrives on tradition. There's a lot of, you know, comparison that's done generation to generation, and I think they've been probably too protective of sort of the traditions of the game and get in there under the hood and make adjustments to speed up pace of play. You're right, you know, the game, you know, especially when you're talking about first pitches that go off, you know, after 8 o'clock and games that end after 11, 11:30, sometimes midnight, you know, that's just too much of an ask on somebody when you're talking about a 7-game series. So I think baseball can't afford to just, you know, hope for big market teams to bail it out in its product. They need to keep messing around with it a little bit.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay. He's written a piece entitled, As NFL Wobbles, Is This Baseball's Time? If the World Series is baseball's time, given these two fantastic teams in Houston and L.A., does that translate to, say, opening day next year in April?
You know, we didn't necessarily see that this year with sort of a Cubs carryover, right? You know, nothing would be bigger than the Cubs winning the World Series. I mean, it hadn't happened in, you know, 107 years.
Yeah,
Yep. You know, we did see, you know, obviously exuberance in Chicago. Did it translate to the rest of the country? You know, baseball is a little bit more of a regional sport. You know, of course, it's a 162-game season. You're focused on your team, your favorite team. You're not necessarily watching out-of-market games like you would in football, where there's fantasy and betting and all that kind of stuff.
True.
Propelling the fascination. Baseball, you know, again, their attachments tend to be more local. So, different kind of vibe altogether. But again, Gordon, I think this is an opportunity for baseball to, you know, continue to get underneath the hood, make adjustments, accelerate things. You know, Gordon, I'm on the record of saying I like seven-inning games on weeknights. That's a little bit of a radical idea, but I think it can catch hold. What do you think?
Yeah, what I think is I want to see the hate mail that started to fill up your inbox after calling for a seven-inning game during the week.
You know, it's funny you should say that, and I'll be totally candid with you. I mean, there were some people who were like, absolutely don't mess with baseball, you know, get out of our sport. But I was surprised by the number of people who, you know, if they weren't supportive of necessarily that idea, did feel that baseball needed to make some, you know, significant alterations to pace of play because it is a problem. You know, you think about how your attention wanes when you're watching it at home on television, but this is even true of the live product. You know, people are leaving games early. You go to a Yankee game in the middle of the season on a Tuesday night, you know, you look down at the stadium in the sixth inning, if it's a long game, people are walking out. And that's not great. And I don't think there's any reason why we need to be so protective of these traditions to the degree that we don't do anything.
And are you comfortable with this new format in which two National League teams compete for the World Series?
Yeah, you know, it is funny that people, there is a sort of a small quadrant of the internet that seems to feel like this is somehow a sacrilegious World Series because the Astros were in the National League up until 2013. I don't feel the same way. You know, you have to win where you are, and, you know, the Astros took on and beat all comers. They beat the class of the American League to get there. I don't think this is somehow an illegitimate World Series club. They're terrific.
Thanks, Jason. It's Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay. 22 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Thanks for being with us. With Americans regularly taking more pills than ever, the amount of harm stemming from inappropriate prescription medication is staggering. Almost 1.3 million people went to emergency rooms due to adverse drug effects in 2014, and about 124,000 of those people died from those events. Time for a look at what should and should not be in your medicine cabinet. Lisa Gill is deputy editor at Consumer Reports. Lisa, scary numbers you came up with.
Really, half of all adult Americans take an average of about four prescription drugs, and that number has basically nearly doubled in the last 20 years. Over 4 billion prescriptions were filled last year, which is just a phenomenal amount, and that's just at the retail pharmacies. And the second thing we learned was that out of that, there's an amazing amount of harm that happens. More than 1 million people almost every year go to emergency rooms because of drugs that cause side effects or drugs that interact together creating side effects or very rare adverse events that are quite severe. And the other final thing that is that we figured out that if you had some kind of medication review every year, you would be able to cut down that risk for you by half. And so that's substantial. If you could keep half those people out of the emergency rooms, that would be amazing. So we came up with this idea to really encourage consumers to have a medication review with a pharmacist, your local pharmacy, or your physician. You should do it a minimum of once a year. But you know what? If you do it every time you go to the doctor, you would be far ahead of the curve, and that's actually the safest thing.
I'm still picking myself off the floor after that opening stat you gave in which you said half of Americans, if I get this right, half of Americans take at least four prescription medications. Did you mean regularly or like at some point during the year?
I mean regularly. That is drugs that people have taken for 3 months or longer.
Wow.
And it's that number's on the rise. And I should be clear, you know, medications, there's no question, there are tremendous life-saving medications out there.
Yes.
So nobody should stop taking stuff as a result of listening to this. You should absolutely talk to your doctor or talk to your pharmacist about what you take and make sure that you really need it. But the thing that is so scary is the amount of harm is substantial and pervasive, and it can be prevented.
What kind of harm are we talking about here? We talk about if you take, say, an expired drug, or you're taking one too long, or you're mixing.
Expired drugs are actually probably give you the least amount of harm.
Okay.
And most medications can be taken about a year, even after, at least over the counters can be taken a year after that expiration date. But I'm talking the kind of harm that it can be anything: liver failure, kidney damage, heart problems, stroke. There's an endless amount of physical health harms that can happen as a result of taking some of these drugs. And the main thing is, you may not need that kind of risk exposure because the drug may not be actually very effective for you. And the shocking thing that we found out is that if you take all your drugs to your physician and you ask, hey, can I stop any of these meds? It is more than likely than not that you will be able to stop taking. Your doctor will identify one drug that you can stop taking.
Man.
And that's a good thing. That will substantially reduce how much harm you're exposed to. So that's why we're recommending to have your medications checked. And, you know, most of the time it's free, believe it or not. Retail pharmacies will do this for free for you. And if they do a more in-depth review along with your doctor, both doctors and pharmacists may be able to bill your insurance for it. Gordon, you've probably figured out that, you know, multiple doctors write multiple prescriptions for people.
So, and they're not talking to each other.
No, they're not talking to each other, and it's incumbent upon you to be your own health advocate, or in your case, you know, working on behalf of your parents or your wife. And so this is it puts all the burden on the person.
Thanks, Lisa. Lisa Gill, deputy editor at Consumer Reports. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Prices are for base buildings only. Do not include windows, doors, or accessories. Warning! Don't let your business get left behind in what is likely to be the biggest economic boom in recent history. If you need to build to grow your business, call General Steel today. Steel prices are expected to rise, but you can still lock in your price on a General Steel building if you call now. For example, a 40 by 60 foot building is still less than $25,000. Even an 80 by 150 foot building is under $99,000.
Imagine 12,000 square feet for under $99,000.
This building is designed for your needs, no wasted space. And you get the General's quality and 50-year structural warranty at a price you can afford. You can still save as much as half the cost and time of conventional construction by calling General Steel today. As much as half. So don't let rising steel prices put your project out of reach and stop you from making your company great. Call now. 877-61-STEEL.
It's not too late. Call.
877-61-STEEL. That's 877-617-8335.
Well, there's a group in England called the Active Resistance to Metrication, a tiny group that has for years been pushing the UK to go back to its old weights and measures. Britain's planned exit from the European Union has breathed new hope into this campaign. More from This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
How do you get rid of the metric system with ladders and sticky letters? Jenny Gross of the Wall Street Journal has written about a group of people in England who want nothing to do with the metric system and joins us now. Jenny, who are these folks?
So it's a group of mostly men who are retired, and they have for many years now made it their mission to get rid of the metric system in the UK. And I mean, the UK is in this interesting position where it's really uses a mix of both metric and imperial, and they think there should be no mention of metric anywhere in the country.
How are they actually physically doing this?
So they meet from time to time at one of their houses, and they drink tea and eat sandwiches and plan these raids where they go out and drive in car, they pile into one car and go out and with a stepladder and some stick-on numerals, they will go up to any sign that's in the metric system and paste over it numbers that are in miles instead.
Do they get in trouble for doing this?
So the lead, the leader in the group, Tony Bennett, he has been arrested 7 times and convicted once. And it's always an option, although what they say is that what they're doing isn't actually illegal because road signs in the UK are supposed to be in the imperial system. But sometimes local officials will put up signs in the metric system. For instance, where I wrote the story, the local official said that, you know, it's helpful to have signs in kilometers because sometimes people are training for 5 or 10Ks.
We're speaking with Jenny Gross of the Wall Street Journal. Jenny, what does Brexit have to do with their campaign to make changes?
So in some ways, Brexit has breathed new life and new hope into their campaign because as the UK is figuring out all of these questions about itself, you know, whether it wants, you know, what color its passport should be, what type of foreign policy it should have after Brexit, and really deciding what kind of new country it should be, these guys are saying that now is the opportunity for the UK to push back to exclusive use of the imperial system. The government, however, has said that this really isn't an option.
What is the government's position? I mean, you mentioned some things are in the imperial system, some are in the metric system. Is there some official British regulation about anything?
There is, and it's incredibly complicated and confusing. And so certain items can be in the imperial system. So pints of cider and beer and milk, for example, precious metals can be weighed in troy ounce. Speed limit signs are in the imperial system. But when you go to a market in the UK and you buy, for example, some apples, the prices have to be in both the metric system and the imperial system, and that's because of an EU mandate. So, I mean, the EU wanted to impose these regulations so that to standardize trade in between countries. But these guys say it's an affront to a longstanding British tradition and part of Britain's heritage to erase the imperial system. So this is really a protest against the EU.
Jenny, don't the two systems confuse the public?
Yes, and it's funny you say that because not only in the UK, but in other places too, there have been examples where an Air Canada plane in the 80s ran out of fuel because there was a misunderstanding about the terms that the fuel was weighed in. So it landed safely and no one was seriously injured. But there have been lots of confusion, and I spoke to some Americans who said that, you know, even cooking and baking is incredibly complicated because cookbooks will use both systems.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Jenny Gross. So like all technologies, smartphones are transitory. We're starting to give phone capability to wearable technology and beginning to explore mixed reality headsets, which are the more likely of the two technologies to replace smartphones at the top of the personal communications food chain. But tech analyst Rob Enderle says for a mixed reality headset to displace a smartphone, it will need to evolve a lot from where it is. Rob, first off, what is mixed reality?
Well, so mixed reality is when you have a kind of a combination of AR and VR. AR is augmented reality, VR is virtual reality. And what it is a technology that makes it very difficult to differentiate between what is real and what is rendered. So from the standpoint of what you can see, mixed reality could have a dragon in your driveway that is indistinguishable from a dragon in your driveway, and from your frame of reference, you could have that dragon eat your car, and it would look to you like it was eating your car. So it would be very much like you could place yourself in Game of Thrones, but with everything that's there physically there around you still there around you, and so objects like cars or other people could appear like rock sculptures or orcs or something. So mixed reality is kind of the next big thing in that it blends the virtual world with the real world and makes the two indistinguishable from each other.
Does this mean that at some point we're all going to be wearing funky helmets?
Well, that's one of the problems we're dealing with. I mean, the article really speaks about what comes after the smartphone, and one of the problems right now for any of these headsets, whether it's AR, and we saw Google Glass, which has kind of made you look stupid, and VR, which even makes you look more stupid, some of the AR stuff now starting to look like dark glasses. And so if the technology is going to have to be something we're going to accept, and so it could be a helmet. My argument right now is if we really need to rethink the VR headsets, and really designed them into helmets so you kind of look cool wearing it, because right now you look like a dork if you're wearing a VR headset, the big honking screens coming off the front of your face.
Right.
Eventually the technology will probably be surgically implanted in your eyes. So it will be indistinguishable from the outside, probably tying into your optical nerve, your optic nerve behind the eye directly, and it might be on your back or in your side or something else, but it would be implanted in a way that you wouldn't be able to tell. Somebody else wouldn't be able to tell it was there.
Did you just take us a step toward human beings becoming robots?
Well, probably more towards the singularity. That's something that's expected in the 2050 time frame when it becomes virtually impossible to tell the difference between man and machine. We embed technology so deeply that organic and mechanical aspects of it are all part of the same object. But we're ways off from that, and we clearly have some both surgical and cultural obstacles to overcome long before then. But near term, I'm really talking about the beginning of this, and that's basically getting another prosthetic type of device, but one that looks much more attractive and one we're much more likely to accept on our head all the time.
I'm so weirded out by this conversation right now. I can't even process it. We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. He's written a piece entitled "When Smartphones Become Obsolete." All right, so visit that. What's going to happen with the smartphone?
Well, so now we're moving back more near term. So we're messing around with a lot of stuff right now. Our personal assistants, like the Amazon Echo, which has the Alexa voice, and of course now we've got the Apple and Google and Microsoft counterparts coming to market. And this gives us, of course, I have to watch it every time I say that word, the Echo word. My Alexa in the office wakes up and starts wanting to answer questions.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. Glad you could spend some time with us during this year's Halloween celebrations. Make sure you're not setting yourself up for a truly frightening pet-related bill. Veterinarians often see an uptick in emergency visits around Halloween. Here's Kelly Grant, consumer reporter at CNBC.com. Kelly, what are we looking at?
A lot of the claims do tick upward, particularly things related to chocolate toxicity, because you know your curious pet has suddenly access to a lot of Halloween candy, both in the house, if they're out trick-or-treating, kids maybe have dropped stuff, and that can cause a lot of problems, unfortunately.
We've always heard that, right? That chocolate, for example, is dangerous for especially dogs, cats. I don't know why, but that's kind of the standard thing, isn't it?
Well, it's one of those, there's certain ingredients, they say the big three to watch out for are chocolate, sugar-free candies containing xylitol, and really anything with raisins. Those are the big ones where they can have side effects, including things like organ failure and seizures.
Goodness.
So you'd really want to watch out. And there's a lot that goes into what is considered a toxic dose for your pet.
Okay.
But around Halloween, when they have access to so much, it's usually safer to go to the vet and let them sort it out, because it's hard to be certain that did they eat one, you know, fun-size mini candy bar from the bowl, or did they eat six? That's hard to tell.
Right. All right. And, you mentioned costumes and decor. This is kind of a choking hazard for them?
Potentially. Pets like to chew on just about everything. I have a cat that eats all sorts of things he shouldn't. I can personally attest to this. And so the vets say they do see an uptick in the animals that come in. They've either eaten part of their own costume, part of your kid's costume, some of the decor. So you just always got to keep an eye out on, you know, what's on their level and what is unexpectedly enticing.
Right. What do you do in an emergency like that?
Well, you definitely want to head to the vet. I mean, that's some of the stories of things that they have found that pets have eaten. You know, we've written about this before, you know, scary things like glass Christmas ornaments, all the way to, you know, as I said, weird pieces of costumes and other parts of clothing.
Yeah. We're speaking with Kelly Grant, consumer reporter at CNBC.com, about her piece entitled Three Halloween Hazards That Can Lead to Scary Vet Bills. All right, what's the third one?
Third one, we dubbed it seasonal scares, but it's just, you know, this idea that you don't know how your pet's going to react to potentially scary things around the holidays. You've got a lot of costumed people in some pretty frightening costumes. Some pets just don't like the fact that trick-or-treaters are going to repeatedly be showing up at the door in their space. Maybe they want to pet the kids want to pet them, and they're not cool with that. There's a lot that can go down that, you know, could scare your pet, and in the process they could injure themselves, another pet, or unfortunately even one of the trick-or-treaters or someone in your home.
Thanks, Kelly. Kelly Grant, consumer reporter at CNBC.com. By the way, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. We use the username at This Morning Show. You can follow me directly on Twitter as well, at Gordon Deal. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. We'll finish with this. How about this for inspiration? A true tale of survival from South Carolina, where the Greenville News tells the story of 8-year-old Jackson Maris of Easley, South Carolina. Jackson's struggles began when he and his twin were diagnosed in the womb with a condition affecting identical twins where one gets too much blood and the other not enough. He wasn't supposed to survive. Once he did, his parents were told they'd be lucky if he'd ever recognize them. Then he wasn't supposed to be able to walk or talk. His surgery as a baby left him with cerebral palsy. But here he is, defying all odds, and he's apparently become a heck of a one-armed golfer. Dad takes Jackson out to the course every day, where they play for at least an hour, and the weekends bring tournaments that they all look forward to. Dad says Jackson did the drive, chip, and putt tournament this last year, came in fifth out of 20-something kids. He says he's going to end up beating me one day, I can promise you that. He says, by the way, nothing beats caddying for his son. That'll do it for this hour. I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.